This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Semiconductor chips are the new oil. That is an assertion made by Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger just last month.
Geopolitics across the world has been defined by where the oil reserves are for the last five decades. For the next several decades, where the fabs are is more important because every aspect of human existence is becoming more
digitized.
Everything digital runs on semiconductors. Build the fabs where we want them.
Gelsinger said that on CNN at Davos. Intel happens to be the world's second largest semiconductor company by revenue. The biggest Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing company is based in Taiwan, which puts it in China's shadow. That's why both the Trump administration and the Biden administration have focused for years on the impact that increasing competition with China could have on key sectors that rely on semiconductor chips, which is a lot of them, in both civilian and military spaces. A fact that President Biden noted in his State of the Union address earlier this month.
These chips were invented in America. Let's get that straight. They were invented in America. We used to make 40% of the world's chips. In the last several decades, we lost our edge. We're down to only producing 10%.
Well, as you might remember, last August, Biden signed the Bipartisan Chips and Science Act, a law that pumps $52 billion in subsidies to semiconductor manufacturing and research.
I'm confident that decades from now, people are going to look back at this week with all we've passed and all we moved on, that we met the moment at this inflection point in history, a moment when we bet on ourselves, believed in ourselves, and recaptured the story, the spirit, and the soul of this nation.
That lofty language from when Biden signed the CHIPS Act. Well, the administration has also been championing more direct domestic investment by chip makers, including the world's largest, that I mentioned before, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which pledged $40 billion to build a new chip plant in Arizona.
All told, TSMC is investing $40 billion here in Arizona, the largest foreign investment in the history of this state. Over 10,000 construction jobs and 10,000 high-tech jobs will be created.
All well and good. But Biden's chip policy doesn't stop at increasing domestic manufacturing and production. The administration has also been actively crafting policy that seeks to prevent China's ability to make more chips. Last October, Biden implemented a raft of federal controls of American chip technology to China. Biden is also enlisting American allies in the effort. Just a few weeks ago, both the Netherlands and Japan, makers of some of the world's most advanced equipment needed to manufacture semiconductor chips, both countries agreed with the U.S. to bar some shipments of that specialized equipment to China. Well, history shows us the lengths the United States has gone in the past to protect access to oil, including both economic and physical war. So if chips are indeed the new oil, how far will the U.S. go now? How far should it go? Trade war? Economic war? Something else? Against China? A nation with greater economic symmetry to the U.S. than any oil-producing nation of the past. That's what we're going to talk about today. And joining us now is Jack Zhang. He's assistant professor of political science at the University of Kansas. He studies the political economy of trade and conflict in East Asia. Professor Zhang, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jordan Schneider. He's an adjunct fellow of technology and national security program at the Center for a New American Security. He's also the China technology analyst at the Rhodium Group, and he hosts the China Talk podcast. Jordan, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let me just first of all ask you both, and Professor Zhang, I'll start with you. What is your response to the fact that both the Netherlands and Japan now have agreed to basically have their own form of export control on semiconductor manufacturing equipment to China?
Yeah, this is a big achievement for the Biden administration and a key way in which their approach to the tech war, as folks call it, differs from the Trump administration, right? The multilateral approach rather than the go-it-alone kind of America First approach. And it's really crucial on this dimension of policy because, you know, if the U.S. unilaterally imposed export controls, other countries and companies could stand to benefit while American companies lose out. So it's a big deal to have these two largest makers of equipment and their governments sort of pressuring. I don't think they did it willingly, right, with some foot dragging there, but to make that commitment.
Mm. So, Jordan, can you then help us understand, so what would be an analogous situation if another country decided to do this to the United States? Because I'm trying to get a handle on how big a deal this is. Like, what could other countries prohibit export to the United Sure. States that would have a similar impact?
So what's interesting is that there honestly isn't a great analogy, because what the U.S. did with the semiconductor export controls is restrict the sort of selling and, you know, technological upgrading of another country at the highest technological frontier. And at least for now, there aren't that many other sort of super high tech, you know, decades long, tens, hundreds of billions of dollars of R&D projects, which other countries could necessarily single-handedly cut off from the U.S. So people talk about potentially China doing something like a rare earth exports ban, but, you know, those are things you can dig out of the ground. That's not the sort of project of decades of research, which is what the U.S. was able to control with the October 7th export controls. So there isn't a near analogy, but China, of course, is, you know, trying to do technological upgrading on its own, and the hope of Xi and the rest of Beijing is that maybe 1 year down the road, they'll be so advanced in a certain technology that they could, you know, potentially use this sort of leverage against the U.S.
Okay, so what do you think about that, though? Because is China and its internal technological development trajectory on pace to be able to overcome these export controls, whether they come from Japan, the Netherlands, the U.S., or other countries?
Sure. With this specific question of the export controls that the U.S. put on October put down on October 7th around that limits the manufacturer as well as purchase of the highest end equipment regarding semiconductors, probably not, at least in the near term, just because this is like basically the hardest engineering problem that humanity has conquered. But there are certainly other industries, like, you know, electric vehicles or batteries, where China is much closer to the technological frontier and does have the real potential of, in a number of years, ending up superseding what the rest of the world is able to put out
okay.
on the market.
Okay. So Professor Zhang, did you want to add to or respond to what Jordan was saying?
No, Jordan, big fan of your work and newsletter, and I think he's absolutely a point. These are choke point technologies, as they're called, right? And they're chosen because a relatively small number of companies can be targeted to have this outsized effect, because, you know, semiconductors go into so many consumer as well as, you know, potentially military applications. I will say, though, that the U.S. is about a quarter of the world's market on this stuff. China is about a quarter as well. And so no matter what kinds of products you're going to, the targeting, right, there's I think there's some hesitancy in going down that road and escalating this conflict further and widening it, right, because potentially companies could be losing out on one or the other of their really large markets.
Including U.S. companies.
Including U.S. companies, right.
Okay. But isn't that fascinating that the U.S. and China together are equal portions of the world's market here? Well, do you know, Professor Zhang, what I want to bring into this analysis then is, okay, if these are choke point technologies, as you said, the number one chip maker in the world right now by revenue, as I mentioned earlier, is just right there next door to China in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in a lot of analysis by, you know, both of you and conversations we've had on this show, that is one of the deep concerns about, speaking of escalation, of China escalating, you know, its position against Taiwan. Mm-hmm. How should we think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important point, but I think this is a place where the analogy between oil and semiconductors is not doesn't quite capture, I think, the nature of the supply chains today, right? So, you know, with oil, crude oil, you can, if you control the source of production, you're good, right? And downstream, you can process it or whatever. And semiconductors are not that, right? They are advanced components that go into other manufactured goods. So the process will flow the other direction, right? TSMC manufactures, they have some fabs in China. They're building more in the United States, and the majority of them are in Taiwan. And so, you know, they're diversified, and they very keenly want to be able to still access and play both of these markets, right?
Yeah, so the sort of...
Go ahead.
Yeah, so the sort of simplistic analogy that some folks are worried about is, you know, Japan, 1940, 1941, the U.S. starts to put on export controls and restricts access to oil. And then part of the big, you know, push with Pearl Harbor was also to go down to the Dutch East Indies and you know, take the oil. That is not a playbook that would remotely work in Beijing's perspective. You know, if somehow... Xi convinced himself that the only way to sort of break out of this choke point was to, you know, conquer Taiwan first, all the fabs would be destroyed in a conflict. And second, these are globalized industries that need to trade both as like inputs for production as well as sale for the rest of the world. And that obviously would not be happening in the wake of a conflict.
Well, Jordan and Professor Zhang, stand by for a minute because we have to take a quick break and we'll pick up our analysis when we come back. We are talking about understanding or making sense of what the Biden administration's China policy is, really overall, through looking at how the Biden administration is acting on semiconductor chips. So hop on social media, Facebook and Twitter, we're at On Point Radio, and let us know what you think. Should the United States enter in or expand a trade war against China to protect and develop our chip making manufacturing capacity, what do you think the downsides of that might be? So let us know. We're at On Point Radio. Back in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Jordan Schneider joins us today. He's at the Center for a New American Security and their Technology and National Security Program. He's also the China Technology Analyst at the Rhodium Group and host of the China Talk podcast. Professor Jack Zhang is also with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Kansas. His focus is on the political economy of trade and conflict in East Asia. And Professor Zhang, I wanted to pick up with what Jordan was telling us about the costs for China if it indeed, you know, invaded Taiwan regarding Taiwan's chip manufacturing capability. Point well taken. It would be likely to be the most devastating hot war that we've seen maybe in the past 50, 60 years. Nevertheless, though, Taiwan's chip manufacturing capability be potential collateral damage if China decided to move into Taiwan for, you know, just nationalistic reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think that will be a big deterrent, right? When we're talking about large-scale wars and in a cross-strait conflict, the U.S. will most likely be involved. So you have the world's two largest economies, two biggest militaries fighting each other. And, there's been a lot of studies to show that the military cost of that conflict would be catastrophic. Now, add to that the fact that the U.S. and China also are the most economically interdependent sort of countries, measured by just sheer trade volume, right, that we've seen, and that East Asia together, right, China trades a lot with Taiwan as well, a lot of, trade geographic supply chains go through that region of the world. The collateral damage economically will also be massive. And so given those costs, right, one would hope that that incentivizes towards caution no matter what direction sort of the winds of nationalism are blowing. It's just against economic and you know, potentially political self-interest, right, to pay those high costs for, I don't know, uncertain gains.
Okay. So obviously these chips are in a lot of stuff, right? Everything from like your dishwasher to many of them in modern cars to military applications. So Jordan, let's just kind of stick with warfare as a sub-theme here. Can you just, was that a sigh? Jordan?
No, it's just sad. But anyways, yeah, please.
Well, I'm only asking because I've been seeing a lot of research and analysis that's around that says that one of the United States' particular concerns is China's desire to continue to rapidly develop its military and that therefore it's going to need, you know, next generation chips, especially as AI comes online ever more in this world. And that's one of the reasons why the United States is acting pretty boldly when it comes to the economic decisions it's making about semiconductor manufacturing around the world.
Totally, yeah. I mean, this was the central justification for the October 7th export controls. Basically, the logic went that, you know, China is a strategic competitor and chips are absolutely central to modern warfare. You know, everything from building supercomputers to run simulations around sort of missile and nuclear technology to you know, the sort of models like a ChatGPT that you could then, you know, feed into your military to make it run much more efficiently. So, you know, the final piece of the puzzle that led to that was the idea that sort of the entire Chinese private sector would potentially be subject to being forced into doing sort of military economic, sort of political, you know, civil military fusion such that the U.S. couldn't comfortably sell these potentially dual use technologies into China without the real worry that they would end up being used for military purposes.
Okay, so Professor Zhang, Jordan talked about how this was the justification for the U.S.'s export controls from October. Is it an adequate justification?
Well, that's from a international trade perspective, and this is where I think the Chinese government has raised complaints, right? These are against sort of international trade norms. From, I think, a larger strategic perspective, I think the big question is going to be what are the second-order consequences, the externalities, right? So if it goes according to plan, then, you know, this effectively caps sort of the technological capacity of Chinese industries, but also certainly the Chinese military, and helps the U.S. sort of maintain this edge, and that's a good outcome strategically. The bad thing that might happen is as China invests more in indigenous innovation, that it manages to advance in these technologies and catch up, and then you're going to be in this kind of an arms race scenario. And I think it's important to raise, you know, historically, I think we have some analogies for this type of thing, right? I'm thinking about U.S. export controls on satellite technology in the wake of 1989, so the Tiananmen Square massacre. So the U.S. was hoping to cap sort of the capacity of the Chinese space industry, and the Chinese government responded by investing heavily, right, and developing indigenous technologies for rockets and satellites and so forth. If it doesn't work, right, and you just help China run faster and, you know, be more sure that you know, you're in an adversarial relationship, well, then that's an unintended consequence, right, of this policy.
Okay. Well, I want to just listen quickly to what one of the leaders in the Netherlands said about the new agreement that was just announced a couple of weeks ago about the Netherlands and Japan not sending some of their most high-tech manufacturing equipment to China any longer. So this is ASML CEO Peter Vennick, and he spoke with CNBC last month about what he thinks the new agreement will do to his company's trade relationship with China.
You know, unless anything changes, we will actually keep shipping our deep UV systems, which is the workhorse of the industry today, but export controls on EUV, on extreme ultraviolet, are still valid. I mean, we cannot ship those.
Okay, Jordan, can you just decipher that quickly? What's the difference between the deep UV system and the EUV?
Sure. So DUV is what the industry has been running on for decades, but EUV is the are the machines that help semiconductor fabs make the most advanced chips. So stuff that's in your latest, iPhone or laptop, all requires this particular machine that only ASML makes, which costs hundreds of millions of dollars. They can only make, you know, a few dozen a year. And, it is like the crown jewel of sort of decades of research and R&D, which ended up being developed. So in China, in its quest to make cutting edge, leading edge semiconductors at scale, really needs these machines that the U.S. and the Netherlands have decided their firms are no longer able to get.
Okay. Well, again, the military, potential military applications keeps popping up because Venick also has told CNBC that the restriction on exports to China will not affect the use of semiconductor technology in the military.
When you think about the semiconductor usage in military applications, you have to realize that many, many of those military applications use very, very mature chips. They're very often 10, 15 years old. Why? Because they're rugged. You know, they can withstand extreme conditions. So it will affect, I think, more generally, the availability for chips in the industry at large, and not specifically in the military application, because that's already there.
So, Professor Zhang, how do you decipher that? Does that mean that the Biden administration's wish to prevent China's military applications or usage of these chips is not going to happen?
Well, it's already happened, but yeah. I think the Biden administration views the economic consequences potentially as positive knock-on effects, right? You take these actions, you justify it on national security grounds, and if it also helps American companies like Intel or Qualcomm, that's great, right? That's like winning twice. But I think, you know, the CEO of ASML probably knows his business and knows sort of what the end use for this stuff is, and it's a good point that, you know, if it's not the most cutting edge things that's going to help China get maybe the next generation of whatever, weapon system or AI to be used for military applications, but actually, right, that this is going to have a wider sort of economic impact because the end users, right, are going to be concentrated on the lower end stuff, and it's going to be the civilian applications. The market's always bigger, right, and all over the world than the military stuff. Then maybe the economic consequences are going to be actually the first order sort of stuff, there will be, I think, then the concerns about whether you should do this on, justifying sort of trade restrictions, export controls on national security grounds is a problem for international trade and might result in a kind of a race to the bottom kind of dynamic.
Mm. Okay. So if I may, I'd like to kind of reset our conversation here because I thought it was important for us to spend quite a bit of time understanding what, the recent announcement from the Netherlands and Japan meant and how to make sense of that. But I'd like to now come back to the original thesis that we started with and just want to hear briefly from you, yes or no. Do you think, Jordan, I'm going to start with you, that chips are the new oil?
Sure.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to come back to that. Professor Zhang, yes or no?
No.
No. Okay, so let's go back to Jordan. Describe to me why you had that hesitant sure.
Look, I mean, it depends on what standard you want to, like, what's our burden of proof for the analogy? Are semiconductors really important to the global economy? Yes. Will they continue to be really important to the global economy in the decades ahead? Yes. How similar are the sort of, like, to what extent are the dynamics and the sort of geopolitics of oil in the 20th century going to be analogous to semiconductors in the 21st? probably not that similar because, you know, as the professor said earlier, this is an incredibly globalized industry with a globalized supply chain where, you know, no one country can really do even, you know, more than 10% of this on their own. So in order to, you know, reach the sort of technological marvels that the semiconductor industry has been able to produce over the past decades, they've had, you know, at the cost that, you know, keeps computers and cell phones and cars affordable, the U.S., we have had to do this sort of globalization. And I don't think there's a world in which even in this new environment where industrial policy is in vogue again, and you're seeing stuff like the CHIPS Act getting passed, that, you know, inherently interdependent globalized nature of the semiconductor industry is going to go anywhere anytime soon.
You know, you packed a lot into that. Sure. But so Professor Zhang, when I played that tape earlier from Intel CEO, Pat Gelsinger, I mean, he's the one who said, and Jordan just sort of pulled the rug out from what Gelsinger said. But just to remind folks, Gelsinger said that he thinks geopolitics specifically for the next several decades are going to be influenced, if not determined, by the need for these semiconductor chips. Now, you said chips are not the new oil. So do you think that Pat Gelsinger is just wrong?
The reason I said no is because I think the key thing that why oil is important, right, is that production for it is geographically constrained. So it incentivizes competition for territory potentially, right? But that's not true for semiconductors for all the reasons that Jordan pointed out. So control over any piece of land, right, the real estate of Taiwan, I don't think China wants it more because TSMC is there because, you know, you could... TSMC could, if they wanted to, right, they could move all of their fabs to the United States, but they're not choosing to do that. Why are they not choosing to do that? Because it would make economic sense for them, right? So that geographic bit is very, you know, I think is very important.
And so therefore, okay, so I hear what both of you are saying. So help me then understand if, are the lengths that the Biden administration is going to now, would you call it a trade war with China over semiconductor technology, Professor Zhang?
The U.S. and China have been in a trade war since 2018,
yep.
Right? And the tariffs that have been put in place by the Trump administration, they haven't gone away, right? What I would say the change is in this new front, if you will, of this economic competition is that the Biden administration is choosing to take a more targeted approach, maybe a, call it a rifle approach over a shotgun approach of tariffs, right? A target a specific, you know, technology that have that outsized influence. And that is different than the previous administration. But on the other hand, they've kept all of the tariffs that have, you know, most of the tariffs that have been put into place, and there's no signs that those are going to be wound down. And so it just then looks like it's firing with a new weapon, right, and continuing with the other one that's causing a lot of collateral damage to, you know, to businesses here in the United States as well as consumers. And so, you know, in that sense, it's different, right? But the economic conflict has been happening for over the last 5 years.
Jordan, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, as Jack said, this is now a real competition, and it has been sort of the sort of competitive. We've had 40 years of the U.S. and China after sort of reform and opening started, of America, you know, helping China on its merry way with a little blip around Tiananmen, but sort of Chinese growth and technological upbringing. Sort of upgrading for decades has been something that the U.S. has really cheered on and encouraged. And that's changed for a number of reasons. But in particular, you're seeing this play out really dramatically in the semiconductor context, where the U.S. has made a bet that the sort of promote work that's going to be going on with the tens of billions of dollars spent on the CHIPS Act, combined with the export controls, is going to end up leaving the U.S. and the rest of the world in a stronger place relative to China in the coming years ahead. And we'll just have to see whether or not that bet turns out to be right.
Okay, so you said that the United States, you know, cheering on and supporting China's development, which had correctly, you said, had been going on for decades, has changed for a number of reasons. quickly tell me what you think some of those reasons are, because the one that jumps to my mind more than anything is, oh, wait, now China actually is incredibly powerful politically and economically, and maybe we're regretting supporting China as much as we had?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd actually end up putting a lot of this at Xi Jinping's feet. The sort of trajectory of Chinese domestic governance has made the U.S. and the rest of the world a lot less comfortable with where the country is headed. You know, we now have a leader who is decided he's not going anywhere, has centralized power, become much more aggressive in international relations, as well as done some pretty objectionable things in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, as well as other minority regions, to the point that I think sort of the U.S. could end up turning its eyes to a lot of what China has done in the past decades, but now is really, uncomfortable where China's going. And that sort of multiplied by China's increasing national power is something that the U.S. and the rest of the world is really starting to get worried about.
Okay, Jordan Schneider and Jack Zhang, hang on. We've got a lot more to talk about in just a minute. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On Friday, everyone, we're going to do a really interesting show about Amazon and its latest steps into U.S. healthcare, because you might know that Amazon recently launched a new program called RX Pass, and it's where Amazon Prime members, for just $5 a month, can get an unlimited amount of dozens of generic prescriptions. So Amazon has been moving pretty aggressively into the prescription drug market. And so we want to know if you have signed up for this service. What do you think of it? What do you think of the idea of Amazon in prescription drugs, upsides, downsides? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. Or better yet, download the On Point Vox Pop app to your smartphone, and that way you can send us a really high-quality message about your thoughts on Amazon and the prescription drug market. So if you don't have the app, again, it's the On Point Vox Pop app. Just get it wherever you download your apps from. So that's for Friday. Today we're talking about the United States and China and economic warfare. Potential of economic warfare over semiconductors. And it's really a kind of one of our ways of looking at the Biden administration's China policy overall. I'm joined today by Jordan Schneider and Jack Zhang. Jordan is at the Center for New American Security and host of the China Talk podcast. And Professor Zhang is a professor at the University of Kansas. He specializes in the economics of trade and conflict in East Asia. Now, Professor Zhang, I'm going to get us back to the semiconductor issue here in more detail in a second. But Jordan said something that I just can't resist, okay? I would make the argument that if China had limited, as it developed, had limited all its the negative decisions as we see them, as Jordan pointed out, you know, its treatment of ethnic and religious minorities, its mass surveillance, et cetera, all the things that have been going on in China that the United States looks sort of looks negatively upon. If it had been limited to that, maybe we wouldn't care. But the real problem is that China is able and has been able to project its power internationally. And that is what's driving the United States to continuously amp up its responses to China on things like semiconductors. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you both make really excellent points. To build on what Jordan was saying earlier, I think one of my mentors, Susan Shirk, has a new book called Overreach that outlines a lot of this dynamics of how under Xi Jinping in particular, but really her book says it predates this, right? That China's engaged in a bunch of things that the end result of which is an overturning of this American expectation about where engagement, right, economic interdependence between the two countries are headed. And I think you're right in that, there's certainly a lot of these dimensions that we'll point out in China's foreign policy, but really a lot of these are domestic policies that we might take issue with. You can say the same for U.S. taking issue with a number of other countries that are engaged in things that are not fantastic. I think the variable that is important to highlight here is the relative power, right? 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, I don't think many analysts in the U.S. took seriously China's technological, you know, competitiveness and potential. And a lot of people dismissed, right? And they're like, well, they're, you know, it's going to take a long time for them to catch up, or they're only good at copying and not, you know, not innovating and so forth. And so that talk is, I think, gone by the wayside. But unfortunately, in its place, I think something worse, which is this great fear and anxiety that it's driven, I think, by the power transition that is happening is now more, has a bipartisan sort of buy-in right here in the United States.
Yeah. Well, so you said a really important phrase there. It's relative power, because relative power is relative, right? It's also what we're seeing here, just an acknowledgement that, in a sense, regarding semiconductor chips, that we've done this to ourselves. I mean, Jordan, in the State of the Union address, we played that little bit earlier, President Biden said, you know, we're down to manufacturing 10%. Of the chips we need versus 40% from I don't know however many years ago. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so that dynamic in particular is an interesting one. Like, why did all this manufacturing go overseas? There's a reason Santa Clara County has the most Superfund sites in America. Making chips is incredibly dirty. And, there's sort of like cost concerns as well as environmental concerns led to a lot of this manufacturing ending up going overseas. And yes, there are sort of knock-on effects where you lose the sort of return, the sort of network effects of returns to sort of innovation that you get having it all localized. But, the decisions that were made that led that number to go down were sort of justified at the time. And also, you know, it's not globalization and sort of returns to trade and specialization ended up being, I think, as a necessary component of giving us the semiconductor ecosystem that we have today that's able to make so many chips at such a high level that we can live a life that we would expect in the 2020s. So, I think the concerns that sort of Biden and the rest of the American political community had around trends in the semiconductor ecosystem are justified, but they're not without, they didn't happen like randomly. They happened for a reason.
Professor Zhang, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, so I think I want to put it something like this, right? So about relative versus absolute gains, right? I think we have a shift of mentality now towards a belief that the government needs to be more active, you know, in industrial policy and manage some of these things. But that original shift of production overseas, for the reasons Jordan pointed out, that decision was also not made at the government level, right? That was made by firms and those local sort of communities, driven by market sort of considerations. And markets are really good at growing the pie, right? Make us more efficient, more and cheaper goods. And those are good things, right? But markets are not great at allocating and distributing things. It's not good at the relative power bit, right? And so you can end up with, right, a flight of jobs or a flight of this technology, and governments are stepping in. But I would say, right, that this is a difficult thing to calibrate, right? Because we don't want to, in the effort of trying to gain more parity or give the U.S. a larger share of whatever good we're talking about, right, lose out and, end up having a smaller pie as a consequence, right? The hope is, well, we can get a bigger, chunk of the pie, but everyone else would still have some, right? But there's a real danger here in the embrace of industrial policy and economic warfare, right, in that measures that are put into place by one country to help boost its own industry or whatever will cause other countries to close off their markets. And so that spirals to the point where, you know, we're in a world that, right, we don't have a lot of globalization, we don't have a lot of, a lot of trade anymore, and the pie is smaller, right? So even if you have a bigger share of a smaller pie, you still have less than what you began with. That's the danger, I think, of this new era of economic competition and industrial policy we're heading into.
But certainly those dangers have in a sense, always existed and just ideally require, you know, constant intelligent calibration of policy when the risks become too high.
Sure, but I think what we're seeing is this pendulum swing, right? Where, you know, neoliberal, the triumphalism of the post-Cold War era was markets know best, right? Governments, the best thing governments can do is get out of the way, right? And we're seeing a correction in that, and some of that correction is probably warranted, but I think we should be aware and not overcorrect and have the pendulum swing too far the other direction, right?
Jordan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, look, when you sort of lead the markets on its, when you let the markets do its thing, you have, you know, fantastic, wonderful things happen, like the creation of a globalized semiconductor ecosystem. But there are also sort of externalities and public sort of collective action problems, which only governments can solve. So, you know, something like supply chain security, right? That means you translate it into doing things for more money, less efficiently, that you have to pay extra for the sort of insurance that no individual firm is necessarily going to pony up for. But the U.S. might want to if, like, we as a nation decide that we want an insurance policy if something something really bad happens in East Asia with semiconductors in particular. So, you know, these are real trade-offs. And because the U.S. is growing less and less comfortable with its sort of interconnections and dependence on China, you're starting to see a lot more of these sorts of investments and steps to create, that end up having the U.S. government play a larger role than it really has for the past few decades.
So, but paying more money to get things less efficiently, though, is that not the cost of strengthening domestic and national security? I mean, I think Biden isn't saying that part out loud, but it's the implication, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a trade-off, and the hope is that it won't just be that, right? The idea is that you'll have these sort of multiplier effects with the manufacturing incentives, where you kind of kickstart an ecosystem. There's also a big investment on the R&D side to kind of create the future of what's going to happen after sort of Moore's Law runs its course, and you know, whatever that future ends up being will end up being something that America can lead in. So it's not quite as simple, but I do think, I'll stop there.
Don't stop. What were you going to say?
No. I mean, it's really tricky. I think because it's really been striking to me as I've tried to read up on these sorts of trade-offs that not a lot of thought from the think tank and academic community has really gone into at a sort of microeconomic level, understanding what policies make most sense, because this is really a game that the U.S. has not been in for decades now. So, the Commerce Department and the rest of the U.S. government is, and Congress as well, is really building the ship as they fly it, so to speak, in understanding just what's going to be the best way to spend this money to maximize for all these different goals that we've been talking about over the past hour.
Okay, when you say this isn't a game that the United States has been in for decades, is that the domestic reshoring? Is it the trade war aspect? What aspect were you talking about?
I mean, all of the above.
All of the above.
I mean, I think our last like serious trade war was probably with Japan in the early 80s, and same thing with big subsidies to domestic manufacturing. This is something out of the playbook of the mid 20th century, not in the sort of neoliberal moment that we had from sort of Reagan through the Obama and really Trump administration as well.
Okay, Professor Zhang, I totally hear what Jordan's saying, and mm-hmm. then in addition, now this game that we're playing is a game where the our perceived opponent on the other side of the table is China, and I keep coming back to the fact that we're talking about a nation with like basically, in terms of its economic power, very symmetrical to the United States. So I should have asked this a long time ago. From that point of view alone, how effective is a trade war against a country like China when it comes to these technologies that we're talking about?
It's a trillion-dollar question. I probably would have a higher-paying job if I knew the answer with great certainty to that one, right? But, you know, I will echo what Jordan was saying. This is a really challenging sort of policy, you know, calibration policy environment. We're in this new world. But one thing that I want to add is something that you were saying earlier, Magna, that there is – who's paying the costs is a really important thing for us to ask here, right? And there is, you know – research that I've done in my lab here on tariffs, right, backpedaling to something we were talking about earlier, you know, those were justified on national security grounds, right? And they're supposed to help encourage sort of this reshoring or you know, nearshoring or whatever. But the evidence is very clear that we haven't had a lot of that observable sort of positive policy outcomes. But we've had a, you know, prices have gone up quite a bit, right? Companies have passed on those costs of tariffs to their customers and their, you know, and to consumers. And so the long way, or the short way to saying this is, right, a lot of these policies will have redistributive effects, not just across countries. Will it make China stronger or the U.S. stronger? Sure, that's one dimension of it. A lot of them will also have really significant domestic consequences where they'll make maybe some companies really profitable, right? Give them subsidies or whatever, and maybe they'll raise costs for everybody else, right? And for sure, politicians are not going to emphasize that aspect of the, you know, of these policies and this dimension of the competition. And the same thing is going to be happening on the Chinese side as well. And when we have this relationship that's built on economic interdependence and globalization, it means that things that we're doing, right, that tries to gain a little bit of an edge at the international level, right, to make the U.S. hand stronger or whatnot vis-a-vis China will require the sacrifices then of the domestic populace or maybe some companies within that. And that is a really tough, you know, that's a challenge that's even harder than, right, well, who's, you know, well, both are equally sized economic powers or whatever. No, the U.S. is so a bit larger. There's, you know, there's asymmetries there. Mm. But really these domestic costs, right, are going to be really important for us to reckon with.
Okay, so we've just got about a minute left here. That makes me wonder if, let's maintain our idealism that with intelligence and imagination, some policy set could be generated that would not require economic warfare and yet allow both nations to continue their technological development in ways that benefit both the U.S. and China. I know I literally just said something that sounds like a fantasy, but is what you're saying, is the problem domestic politics in both countries that would prevent that kind of solution that's basically anything other than the perception that what we're having here is a zero-sum game, Jordan?
Yes, but I don't know how you solve sort of like, you know, intrinsic factors about the CCP, which I think the U.S. is going to be uncomfortable with, and the fact that America has, you know, treaty allies all around China's borders, which I don't think China's going to reconcile themselves with anytime soon. So, you know, not to end on too big a note of pessimism, but it seems very hard to me to imagine a dynamic, at least in the near term, where the sort of trajectory and tenor of U.S.-China relations ends up changing anytime soon.
Well, I mean, I agree. We don't always want to end up on a pessimistic note. So let's at least say that we've ended up here, at least on a note with more realism, because you both have helped us really understand the dynamics, the economic and political dynamics of the semiconductor policy as we're seeing in the Biden administration. So Jordan Schneider at the Center for a New American Security and the Rhodium Group and host of the China Talk podcast and newsletter. Thank you so much for joining us, Jordan.
Likewise.
And Jack Zhang, assistant professor of political science at the University of Kansas, focusing on the political economy of trade and conflict in East Asia. A great pleasure to have you, Professor Zhang. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.